But for a non-abelian gauge symmetry, and show how you can get masses for non-abelian gauge bosons using the Higgs mechanism. So here's the example we'll consider. SU2 gauge theory. All right. So we'll have not just one complex field, but an SU2 doublet of complex fields. And so I'll call that phi, which is, since it's a doublet, it will have two components, phi1 and phi2. And each of phi1 and phi2 are themselves complex fields. So here is the Lagrangian. The usual covariant derivative, and then we have a potential for phi. And then we need the gauge fields as well. So that would be 1/2 the trace of f mu nu, f mu nu. All right. And then the covariant derivative will be, acting on phi, will be d mu. And then we'll have plus I, G is the gauge coupling, T, A is the generator, and then the gauge field will be A with an A for the gauge index, and then we have a mu, and all of that is acting on phi. All right, and since we're considering SU2, the generators are just the Pauli matrices divided by 2. So TA is Pauli matrix sigma A divided by 2. What else do I need to tell you? Field strength tensor, f mu nu A is d mu A nu A minus d nu A mu A. And then there's the extra term that you get because it's a non-abelian gauge group. So we have G times the structure function, which is just the anti-symmetric tensor, times A mu B A nu C. Okay. And then lastly, we have the potential. So I'll just write that over here. And the potential will just be the same as what we've been dealing with before. We have minus mu squared phi dagger phi. And then we have plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. So I'm going to assume that mu has the sign that we want to give us spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the mu squared parameter would be positive. So the minimum of the potential is at wherever phi dagger phi is equal to v squared over 2, where v is the square root of mu squared over lambda. And as I mentioned, we're assuming that mu squared is greater than 0. Otherwise, there would be no spontaneous symmetry breaking. All right. So this is the model. So far, so good. Now what we want to do is, again, go to unitary gauge. So similar to the abelian case, we want to work in unitary gauge. We're free to choose, of course, whatever gauge we want. But in unitary gauge, it's nice because we can eliminate some of the components of phi. We can just eliminate them from the theory altogether. So we want to choose a gauge where only the real component of phi2 is non-zero. All right. So I can parameterize the field phi as in terms of four real fields like this. We have e to the I ta ca of x over v, and then acting on something like this, 0 in the top, and then v plus h of x divided by the square root of 2. Okay. So we have four fields. We have four real fields, c, 1, 2, and 3, and h. So this is exactly the analog of what we did to write just the simple complex field in terms of polar coordinates. You can write it as a real field times something that looks like the group acting on that real field. Here, we just have one real field like this, and we've just chosen, without loss of generality, to put it in the bottom component. And then we have something that looks like the group acting on that one real field. Okay? So hopefully it's clear I can do this. You can count the degrees of freedom. Phi was two complex fields, so we had 2 degrees of freedom times 2, which is 4. And here we also have 4 degrees of freedom. And so everything matches up. Okay. So now what we want to do is to go to unitary gauge, where we rotate, we do a gauge transformation to eliminate all of these things. So now we'll rotate away the fields C by a gauge transformation. So phi goes to some other field phi prime, which is just e to the minus I t a c a over v acting on the original field. Okay. And so this, of course, will cancel out this. And so then I'm just left with the field that looks like this. All right. All right, so far so good. The next step is you plug it into the covariant derivative, and now we can show how it generates masses for the gauge bosons in the theory. So here's the covariant derivative. Let's see. Ah, yeah, okay. So the covariant derivative term is d mu phi dagger d mu phi. Okay, let's just expand that. There's a 1/2 for the 1 over square root of 2 squared. And then we have phi dagger, which is just that field daggered. So that's 0 comma v plus h. And then I have the covariant derivative. So I have d mu. It should be acting on this field. So let me just write the arrow going like that. I have a minus ig t a mu a. Okay, that's it. Then I have another covariant derivative, which is acting this way, plus ig t a mu a. And all of that's acting on 0, b plus h. All right. So now we can just expand this, just multiply through. You get a 1/2 d mu h squared. so the kinetic term for our leftover Higgs scalar. And then what we have is a g squared over 8 times 0 v plus h. And then we have A, 1, 2, and 3 contracted into all of the different Pauli matrices. So that'll give us something that looks like a 2 by 2 matrix. So I'll just write out what that 2 by 2 matrix is. You get sigma 3 contracted with A3. So that will be here and here in the diagonals. So that will be A mu 3 here and minus A mu 3 here. And then for sigma 1 and sigma 2, those will be in the off-diagonal parts. And those will be contracted into A1 and A2. And so that looks like this. I'll have A mu 1 plus I A mu 2. And in the top, I'll have A mu 1 minus I A mu 2. And so that was just this one. And let me just mention T was sigma over 2. And I factored out that 2 to give us the 1/8. So there's a 1/2. There was a 1/2 from here and a 1/2 from here. That gives me 1/8. All right. And now this matrix was corresponding to this. And so I have another one here. And so I just square it. And then it's acting on 0 VH. OK. Now, again, you can just expand this out. And you get a simple expression. So it's equal to 1/2 d mu h squared. We have a 1/2, and then let me write it as gv over 2 squared. And then I have a mu 1 squared plus a mu 2 squared plus a mu 3 squared. Like this. And then I have 1 plus h over v squared, like this. All right. So what you can see is that all three vector bosons get a mass. A1 gets a mass, A2 gets a mass, and A3 get a mass. And the masses are all the same. So all three vector bosons. A mu 1, 2, and 3 get the same mass. And that mass is MA is equal to just whatever I wrote in parentheses here, which is just GV over 2. All right. So this is sort of on the right track to getting close to the standard model. Standard model has three massive gauge bosons. Here we have three massive gauge bosons. But you can see it's not quite right. In the standard model, the W plus and the W minus have the same mass, but the Z has a different mass. So that doesn't quite fit. Also in the standard model, there's the photon, which is massless. So there's an extra gauge boson as well in the theory, which is obviously not present in this toy model. So let's just say similar to the standard model. But in the standard model, we know that the W mass is not equal to the Z mass. They're not too far off. They're off by, I don't know, 10 or 20% or so. But they're not equal to one another. All right. So we need to go beyond just the simple toy model to get to the standard model. And that's what we'll do now. Any questions on this toy model? Let me just mention one other point. Just like for the case of the abelian Higgs model, you can see that the couplings of the Higgs are related, again, to the mass of the gauge bosons. That's another thing that'll always keep happening. All right. So now we're going to talk about the standard model Lagrangian. So what do we need to do to write down the theory? Well, we need to specify a couple of different things. So we need to know the gauge group. So in that case, it was SE2, but in the standard model, it'll be slightly different. We need to say what are the degrees of freedom. So just what fields you have in the theory. And then you also need to say what are the quantum numbers of those fields. So how do they couple to the gauge fields? All right. So here's the gauge group that ends up working. And this is the standard model gauge group. It's a product of three different groups. SU3, it's written as SU3C, times SU2 with a subscript L for left, cross U1 with a subscript Y. The C here stands for color. And so this is actually the non-abelian gauge group for QCD. And then all of these two things are called the electroweak gauge group. It might be tempting to think this U1 is the same U1 as electromagnetism. It's not the case, right? Electromagnetism will emerge as a combination of these two things, as you'll see. So L stands for left, which comes from the fact that this gauge group only couples to left-handed fermions. And then the Y stands for hypercharge, which just means that it's kind of similar to electromagnetism. There are charges, but they're just called hypercharges, just so you don't get confused with electric charges. Okay. So now we need to specify what are the fields and what are their quantum numbers. All right. So the first field that we'll talk about is Q left. Oops. So this will be left-handed quarks. They have an index I, which labels generation. And it's going to be a doublet under the SU2 since it's left-handed. And so I can write that as U left I. D left I. So the left-handed up and down quarks form a doublet under SE2. That's how the model's constructed. All right. And now what are the quantum numbers? So to label the quantum numbers, I need to tell you how they transform in each of the three gauge groups. And so here's the notation. I'm going to write it as a three-component thing, where the first number tells you how it transforms under SE3 color. The second number tells you how it transforms under SU2 left, and the third number tells you the charge, or I should say the hypercharge, which is related to the U1 hypercharge. So here's the numbers here. So since it's a quark, it carries color. So it has three colors. That means it's a triplet under SU3 color. So I'll write that as a three. It's a triplet. Under SU2 left, it's a two-component object, means it's a doublet. So you write that as a two. And hypercharge is just some integer number, right? It tells you what is the hypercharge of that of this field in units of the gauge coupling. And so the number that you want to choose is a sixth. Why is it a sixth? That's part of the model. So there's no fundamental reason why, just like there's no fundamental reason why it's a doublet, per se. It's just a choice that's consistent with the data, essentially, with describing, you know, quark fields in nature. They have to have this charge assignment to be consistent. with observations. Yeah?
So just to understand, like, the eyes enable the generation, so like, one would be like up and down, two.
Yeah, exactly. Let me clarify that. So
I labels generation. So if I wrote Q left one, that would be like U left, D left, and Q left two would be C left, and then S left, and then Q left three is T left, B left. Okay, is that more clear?
Yeah, and also I was thinking that there's quantum numbers relating, like, I didn't get exactly the 3 and 2, or the exact.
Yeah, okay, good. So the 2 just means it's a doublet. Just means there are two components, that's all.
So, but also like two couplings?
No, there's just one coupling. 2 just means that it's in the fundamental representation of SU2, which just means that it's a two-component vector that transforms under the SU2. So it's like a two-component spinner under the SU2. Is that clear? So then the 3 just means it's a similar thing, but for color. It just means it's a three-component object under color. And the different components are just red, green, and blue. And I haven't written in the color indices here, but I could if you wanted me to. What you would do if you wanted to put in like the full structure under color and SU2 left, you'd actually write like a six-component thing, where you'd have like U left red, D left red, U left green, D left green, U left blue, D left blue. So it would actually have six components. The color, different color components transform under gauge transformations with respect to color, and the U and D part transforms under the SU2.
And in Japan,
there's
a spinner, so they're
Yeah, so each one is a spinner, that's right. So each one is just a two-component spinner, and so then you would say, okay, it's 12 components. But there's no need to write down all these different components, right? It's just implicit. Why is it 1/6? What is 1/6? Okay, so 1/6 is like saying the electron has charge -1. It's just the charge of that object in units of the gauge coupling. Or you would say, you know, a quark has charge 2/3. It tells you that the electric charge is 2/3 times E, the gauge coupling. So in the standard model, when you set it up, there's no U1 for electromagnetism when you start with. There's only a U1 hypercharge, which is similar to electromagnetism, but the charges aren't the electric charges. And so it's just saying that the hypercharge is 1/6 times the gauge coupling.
So which one has a unit
Oh, so it'll turn out that the right-handed electron fields will have hypercharge -1. Okay. So let's continue with the quark fields. We have the left-handed fields, which form a doublet, and then we have the right-handed fields. They're just by themselves. They don't transform under SU2. This is how the theory is set up. I don't know why. I mean, there's no reason that we know of why it's the left-handed fields that transform under the SU2 left and not the right-handed fields, but that's just the model that seems to describe the data. So here's the quantum numbers that you need for the right-handed fields. So again, it's a triplet under color. Again, it's a quark field that has three colors. But it doesn't transform at all under SU2 left. So it's just a singlet under SU2 left, and so you write that just as a 1. And then the hypercharge is 2/3.
Here, like, first two number, like 3, 1, represent like number of, like, whether it's doublet or not, but the last one is represent the strength in coupling.
Yeah, exactly.
last number is different, kind of different font.
It is, yeah. So sometimes people write that differently. Another notation is people use like 3, 2, and then they use a subscript, 1, 6, like this. That's right. So the first two numbers, because they're not abelian gauge symmetries, are really telling you something about the representation. And the gauge coupling is the same, independent of the representation. But for the U1 group, there is no such thing as representations. All you need to know are the different charges. And they can be any number you like. Yeah?
So now the third quantum number is actually the electric charge?
It isn't. For this case, it actually turns out to be the same as the electric charge. But in general, it's not. What we'll see is that the electric charge turns out to be a combination of SU2 left and U1y. And so for fields that don't transform under SU2 left, the hypercharge is the electric charge. But for ones that do, it's more complicated. And we'll see how it works. OK, so the other fields we have are, so we have down type quarks, which are right-handed. And they're, again, it's a triplet under color. It's a singlet under SU2 left, since it's right-handed. And then the hypercharge is minus a third. All right, so those are the quarks. And then we have the leptons. There is a left-handed lepton doublet, which is called L sub L. And so that's the neutrino is up top, left, generation I. And then we have the electron, generation I. And the quantum numbers of that field are, so it doesn't transform under color, it's just a singlet. So I would write a 1 here. It's a doublet under SC2 left, so that's a 2. And then the hypercharge assignment is minus 1/2. We also have a neutrino, right-handed electron I. This is a singlet under color, a singlet under SE2 left, since it's right-handed. And then its hypercharge is minus 1. And you might be tempted to want to write down the right-handed neutrino. So let's just see what that would be. But it's not in the standard model, so we're just going to ignore it. So let's just say you had a right-handed neutrino. Its quantum numbers would be 1. It's a singlet under color. It's right-handed, so it doesn't transform under SE2 left. And then its hypercharge has to be 0. So it actually has no quantum numbers under the standard model gauge group. So people call this a sterile neutrino. All right, but we're not going to consider these extra fields. We're just going to consider the standard model fields, which are the ones above. And then lastly, we need a scalar, which will give us the Higgs. So the Higgs, I'll write as a doublet under SU2. And it has two components, which I'll call H plus and H 0. And its quantum numbers are, well, it's a singlet under color. If it wasn't a singlet under color, then its VEV would break color, which would be bad. We know that color seems to be a good symmetry, since gluons are massless. But it's a doublet under SE2 left, and it has hypercharge 1/2. All right. So this is the Higgs field. It's spin 0. Those are all spin 1/2. This is spin 0. And it's the same as what I wrote before as capital Phi. All right. Now, I wrote the two components as plus and 0. Those will correspond to be the electric charges of those two states, as we'll see. Electric charge. All of the components have hypercharge 1/2. So if I labeled them by hypercharge, it would be H1/2, H1/2, which is not so useful.
Did you say L and E are neutrinos? Where are the L and E particles?
Oh, this?
Yeah.
This is the leptons. So charged leptons and neutrinos. E is electron. Let me write it down here. That's a good question. So the corresponding thing for leptons would be I'd have L1 would be electron neutrino left, and then left-handed electron. LF2 would be muon neutrino left, and then the muon. And L3 would be tau left, and then nu tau left, and then tau left. And then E1 right is electron right. E2 right is muon right. And E3 right is tau right. OK. Is that more clear? Okay. So this is the model. Maybe it's kind of vexing why you have to introduce all these fields and assign charges in these different ways. You should approach it from kind of a phenomenological point of view, where we want to describe, fields in nature, and these are the assignments that you need to describe them. So the standard model doesn't explain why these different fields have these particular assignments and why they are there. It's just what you need to describe the data. Standard model also doesn't describe why you have three different generations. That just seems to be a fact, again, which is not explained in the standard model, but we can accommodate it just by making three copies of each of these fields. Yeah?
So in the standard model, the only boson which is not related to a gauge, which is not like a gauge boson, is the Higgs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there is no, is there any reason for that? Could it be the gauge boson for some other theory or something like that?
It could be. So people have all kinds of ideas and try to how to make the standard model more appealing. So there are different avenues for that. You guys are going to have a course on Beyond the Standard Model Physics, is that right? And so a large portion of Beyond the Standard Model Physics is trying to explain these very seemingly unappealing features of the standard model and trying to explain where they come from. All right. So lastly, let me just also mention, just for the sake of notation, that we also have the gauge boson fields. And so I'm just going to write down what those are. We have three gauge boson fields, or three types of gauge boson fields. So we have SU3 color. The gauge boson field is the gluon. Which I'll write as G mu, and then with a capital index A. And A counts the number of gluons from 1 to 8. And the coupling constant I'll write as G sub S. S stands for strong interaction. We have SU2 left. So I'll call the gauge fields for SU2 left W mu with a superscript A. And A will be 1, 2, 3, corresponding to the three generators of SU2. And lastly, we have the U1y. That just has one gauge boson, and it's called B mu. So that's it. And then the coupling constants for SU2 left, we'll call G. And for the U1, we'll call G prime. All right. So those are the degrees of freedom. Now we can write down the Lagrangian, at least bits and pieces of the Lagrangian. Oops, that's not what I want. So here's the Lagrangian. It has four different types of interactions in it, or four different types of terms. And so I'll divide it up into pieces. We have the gauge part. We have the fermions. We have the scalar part. And then we have the Yukawa interactions. And we've studied all these different pieces in the context of our toy models. And so now we'll study the different pieces in the context of the standard model. So the gauge part is just the usual gauge terms that you would write down for the different gauge fields. Since we have three different gauge groups, we need three different terms that are like f mu nu. So for color, we have a 1/2 trace of g mu nu, g mu nu. For the SU2 left, we have a 1/2 trace of w mu nu, w mu nu. And then for the hypercharge, we have 1/4 v mu nu, v mu nu. OK, that's it. So now let's do the fermions. Again, that's the usual term. So we need to include a fermion. Basically, we just need to copy the Dirac Lagrangian for every single fermion in the theory. So we're summing over all the different fermions. And I'll call them psi. And it's just psi bar I d slash psi. And there's no mass term. Yeah. Yeah, this is the field, and those are the field strengths. So so let me just write it out for B. So here, B mu nu is just the field strength tensor for B. And then I think I just erased it. Yeah. I erased it before, but we wrote down what the field strength tensor for SU2 is. And so I would just copy that. But here I'm just labeling the field strength as W mu nu. And the field itself is just W mu. Is that clear? OK. All right. So now, again, there's no mass term here, right? We couldn't write one down. Because the left-handed and the right-handed components transform differently. So you're not allowed to write down a mass term. It's forbidden by gauge invariance. Next, we have the scalar part, which is exactly what we wrote down before for phi, for the SU2 theory. But I'm just going to change the label of phi to h. But I'm just going to copy what we had before. We have d mu h dagger, d mu h, and then we have the potential, where v of h is minus mu squared h dagger h plus lambda h dagger h squared. Oh, this is great. So now, let me move this up. Oops. All right. The last term is the fermion term. Sorry, I should say the Yukawa term. We're not going to worry about that one for now. We'll come back to it later just because it's a little complicated, and we'll first, we'll work out how spontaneous symmetry breaking proceeds. So the first thing that we want to do is, OK, so the spontaneous symmetry breaking works exactly the same way as it did for the case of the non-abelian Higgs model, right? The potential is exactly the same. All I've done is I've relabeled phi as h. Otherwise, it's exactly the same. And so we can work in unitary gauge, where again, we only need to worry about the bottom component of H, and we can assume that it's real just by using a gauge transformation. So we'll work in unitary gauge. Where h, we can set it to be 0, v plus h of x, and over the square root of 2. All right. OK, I guess I do have to erase this stuff. We do, yes. That's right. And so that's another thing that you need to get, because we know that the W carries electric charge, plus and minus. And so the charge components, which are eliminated from the theory in unitary gauge, will show up as the longitudinal polarizations for the W plus and minus. OK. So we have unitary gauge. All we need to do is just plug that into the covariant derivative term, and then we'll see how the gauge bosons get a mass. And I'm only going to set it up, because in tutorial today, you're going to have to do the rest of it yourself. Yeah?
Where do we have interactions?
Interactions? What kinds of interactions? So there are Yukawa interactions in the Yukawa term, and there are gauge interactions in the covariant derivative. Covariant derivatives that appear in the fermion term and in the scalar term. Those are the only kinds of interactions that we have. There's also Higgs quartic interactions, which are here in the potential, but that's it. All right. So let's just expand what the covariant derivative is. So d mu of h is d mu. And then it's a little more complicated than the non-abelian Higgs model, because I need to include terms in the covariant derivative for both gauge groups, because it transforms under SE2 left and for U1 hypercharge. So for the SE2 left part, I'll have IGTAWA mu. And then for the hypercharge part, I just need to read off what the hypercharge is. It's 1/2. So I put that in as I times G prime times 1/2 times B mu. And all of that is acting on H. So let me just go one step further. We can plug in our expression for unitary gauge here. The derivative, of course, is only going to act on H and not on the VEV. And so we'll have 0 d mu h. And now I have the covariant derivative. Sorry, I have the gauge terms in the covariant derivative. So t, remember, sigma a over 2. So I'll factor out a 1/2 and the I. So I have I over 2. And then I have a matrix W3. Mu times g, then I have minus g w3 mu, and then I have a g w mu 1 minus w mu 2, and the g is multiplying both, and then I have g w mu 1 plus I w mu 2. So that's what we wrote before for the non-abelian Higgs model with just SU2. Now what we have another gauge field, so we can include that in the matrix. If we imagine that it's proportional to the identity acting on SE2 left, so I can write that as plus g prime b mu, and then plus g prime b mu. And all of that is acting on 0 v plus h.
Why is there a factor of 1/2 with the U1 coupling?
The U1 coupling. It's because the charge here is 1/2. So you have to assign some charge. It's like saying that the hypercharge, imagine the electric charge of this field is 1/2 times the gauge coupling. Is that kind of clear? No?
Yeah, so is there a plus one somewhere corresponding to the G cup one there? Because you said a factor of one, right? For the TA, or there is it something?
Is there a plus one? No.
What's the hypercharge corresponding to the W, that term, right, that second term?
This term?
No, this
term.
Yeah.
There's no hypercharge. So the W is the gauge boson for SC2 left, doesn't have hypercharge. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe another way to describe it is, let's say you wanted to write down in QED the coupling of the photon to quarks. The covariant derivative in that case is like d mu, which is like d mu plus I e times 2/3 times a mu, if you're acting on like a quark field with charge 2/3. And so this 2/3 is analogous to like the 1/2 here. It's just your assignment for what that charge is in units of the gauge coupling. Okay. So now all you need to do, and you'll do this, is just plug this into here, and I'll just write down what the answer is, and then we'll go on. You need to do a little bit of work because it's not as simple as the abelian case where all of the gauge bosons are just degenerate with one another. So you need to make some redefinitions of these fields. Notice I don't have any photon, W plus or minus, or Z here because those aren't the fields that I've written down. You need to do a field redefinition where you define the W plus minus fields as 1 over the square root of 2 W mu 1 minus plus I W mu 2. And you also need to diagonalize with respect to W 3 and B mu to get the photon and the Z. And you'll see how that works. But you just need to define the physical fields, which are Z and the photon field, A mu, as linear combinations of W 3 and B. And so those linear combinations are written as follows. You have a mixing angle, which is called theta W. So you have cosine theta W times W 3 mu minus sine theta W B mu. And then for the A field, you have sine theta W times W mu 3 plus cosine theta W B mu. So this will be for the Z boson, and this is for the photon. And you'll see how this works in tutorial. But OK, here's how it goes. You just have to expand this, plug it into here, and use these definitions, and you arrive at the following results. So d mu h dagger d mu h is equal to 1/2 d mu little h. So we still have a real scalar Higgs field floating around. But then we also have mass terms for the gauge bosons. We have a mass term for the W. So it looks like this. W plus mu, W minus mu, multiplying 1 plus h over v squared. And then we have a 1/2 mz squared z mu 1 plus h over v squared. And that's it. I forgot to mention one other thing, which is that the mixing angle, when you diagonalize the mass matrix for W3 and b mu, the mixing angle that you get is related to these gauge couplings G and G prime, right? So the gauge, that mixing angle is can be expressed as tangent of theta W is just G prime over G. And theta W is called the weak mixing angle. It's telling you that, for example, the photon is a linear combination of the SU2 gauge field and the 3 component and the hypercharge gauge field. Similarly, the Z is a linear combination of W3 and the hypercharge gauge field. Yeah?
Why do you have to make these definitions?
You'll see. So you have to wait till 2, and then you'll solve it for yourself. The reason why you need to make them is because if you just express the mass matrix for these gauge fields, it turns out not to be diagonal. And so all you have to do is diagonalize that. I should say it's non-diagonal for the W3 and the B part. For the W1 and W2, it is diagonal. And so the mass term will just like look like W1 squared plus W2 squared. And then you can make this field redefinition, because if you have a mass term that looks like that, there's an additional U1 symmetry. And so you can make this, you can express those two real fields, W1 and W2, as a single complex field, which is what I've done. That's what's going on. Any questions? OK. And then the last thing, OK, so here's the result that you'll show. What are the masses? Well, MW is just G times V over 2. And MZ is G V over 2 cosine theta W. So this is exactly what we want. We have two masses, which are not the same, because we know the W and Z masses are not the same. But they're related in terms of the mixing parameter. So we have MW squared over the mixing cosine of the mixing angle squared is equal to the mass of the Z boson squared. And so you can actually define a parameter called rho, which is MW squared divided by MZ squared cosine squared theta W. And you can measure these things. The mixing angle will end up coming into various interactions, and the masses you can measure experimentally. And so you can test whether or not this relation is satisfied. And of course, at tree level in the standard model, the prediction is just that this is equal to 1. But of course, it gets modified due to loop corrections, which we won't discuss. But at the end of the day, this turns out to be a very nice test of the consistency of the standard model, which relates to the fact that we have symmetry breaking through the Higgs, giving mass to the W and the Z. OK. The other thing that we have is I wrote down mass terms for the W plus and W minus and for the Z, but there's no mass term for the field A mu. That's what we want, again, because we want a one gauge field to remain massless, which is the photon. So A mu remains massless. And this will correspond to the photon field. All right. So what you say is that you started with a theory, which was SU2 left cross U1 y. And this is broken spontaneously to another gauge group, which is just the gauge symmetry of electromagnetism. So you started off with this group here, which has 3 generators plus 1 generator. And 3 of those degrees of freedom get eaten by 3 of the massless gauge bosons to give you 3 massive gauge boson fields plus 1 massless gauge boson, which will be the photon, which remains an unbroken symmetry. All right. Okay, let's see. So now we're going to come to the fermion terms. We'll start them and we'll finish them tomorrow. So here's the fermion Lagrangian. We're summing over all the different fermions in the theory, psi bar I d slash psi. And so let me just expand out what this means. We have lots of different fermions, and they all have different quantum numbers. And so let's just see how that works. So first we have the Q left fields, I. And then we have an I. And then the covariant derivative will look like a d slash plus I g over 2 sigma a w a slash. So that's the SC2 left part. And then I have the U1 hypercharge. So it's G prime times 1/6. And then we have B mu gamma mu, which is B slash. And then we have the strong interaction, which is I GS over 2 times the Gell-Mann matrix, lambda A. We have G A slash. And that's it. And then we have Q left I. So this would be the covariant derivative for the left-handed quark fields of generation I. There's just three terms because we have three gauge groups. The generator for the W is sigma over 2. The generator for color is lambda over 2. That's where those factors come from. And then the 1/6 is just the hypercharge. So let me just write out all of the other terms. We have U right I is I d slash plus I. And there's no SE2 left, so it's just G prime times 2/3. Then we have B slash. We have plus I GS over 2 lambda A G A slash. And then we have U right I. We have D right I D slash plus I G prime. And then we have a minus 1/3 B slash plus I G S over 2 lambda A G A slash D right I. And then the last, and then next we have the lepton fields. Oops. We have I d slash plus I g prime. Oh, let me write the g first. We have g over 2 sigma a w a slash plus I over 2, sorry. I g prime times minus 1/2 for the hypercharge, b slash, and then the fields. And then lastly, we have the right-handed electron I d slash plus I g prime, hypercharge is minus 1, b slash, and then e right I. OK, so that's it.
Hypercharge for the hypercharge has to be a 6 for this, so this first line in particular.
Yeah.
For consistency of the model, like what would go wrong if that were some other number?
So if you made it a different number, so the reason why I chose the hypercharges just so is so that we are able to construct mass terms for the fermions. Remember yesterday. We argue that unless the left-handed, the right-handed, and the Higgs charges are all, you know, perfectly chosen such that the sum of them are zero, we can't write down a Yukawa term to generate fermion masses spontaneously. And so I've chosen the hypercharge such that this works. Yeah, otherwise it would not be gauge invariant. That's right. Okay. So let's just stop there. We'll pick up on this tomorrow. And what we'll show is that once you express these fields in terms of the actual physical gauge fields, W plus, W minus, Z, and the photon, we'll be able to see what are the interactions. And we'll show how the photon couples to the electric charge of these fields. Okay. Any other questions?
Are we saying that if that number was not 1 over 6, we run into that same problem which showed the other day with the gauge invariant?
Exactly.
So there is a deep reason.
There may be a deep reason. Yeah? You will get there. So that's part of the Yukawa term in the Lagrangian, which we haven't written down yet. But that'll be the last thing we get to after we discuss gauge interactions of fermions.
But it's not the Higgs mechanism.
It is. So the Higgs, it's kind of miraculous in fact, that the Higgs is giving masses to both the gauge bosons and the fermions at the same time. And it's just one field that's doing double duty in a sense.